The Bitcoin Standard Toolkit is a selection of Bitcoin services I recommend to my readers and learners on SaferDean.com as they upgrade their monetary operating system from the fiat standard to the Bitcoin standard. These companies are NYDIG, a leading full-service financial services firm dedicated to Bitcoin, applying institutional wisdom and ingenuity to help clients access the unrealized potential of this emerging asset class. NYDIG offers the full suite of solutions needed for financial institutions to access Bitcoin, including custody, execution, financing, treasury solutions, integration partnerships, and more. The team behind NYDIG brings decades of experience in the financial markets and passion for sound money to help provide the rails that will bring about a move to the Bitcoin standard. I have been working as a consultant for NYDIG for 2 years now, and I'm very impressed with their vision, focus, and execution. Go to NYDIG.com to learn more. CipherSafe. To secure your Bitcoins, it is important to keep your seed phrase backed up safely, and for that, I highly recommend using the CipherWheel Seed Storage Device, a gorgeous and brilliant sturdy piece of low-time preference engineering from a fourth-generation machine shop in Maine. The CipherWheel is machined from solid stainless steel, and its unique and elegant design is inspired by secret decoder rings, as well as legendary mechanical engineer Franz Rouleau and the golden age of machine design. If you've read the Bitcoin Standard, you'll know I think the late 19th century was a golden age for many facets of human advancement because of hard money. Bitcoin is bringing hard money back, and our friends at CipherSafe are giving Bitcoin the low-time preference machines it deserves from the golden age of design. Go to CipherSafe.io to get the CipherWheel for your Bitcoins. OKCoin. Whenever someone asks me how to invest in Bitcoin, my advice is to accumulate Bitcoins periodically for the long run, or what is called dollar cost averaging. When you buy every day, week, or month, you channel Bitcoin's volatility to your advantage. In the long run, this strategy will outperform every other Bitcoin investment strategy, probably, except for amazing luck, perhaps. The best place to do recurring purchases is OKCoin because they have the lowest fees for recurring Bitcoin purchases you will find anywhere. If you're stacking sats for the long run, every sat matters, and the fees with each purchase will add up. That's why I recommend you buy at the lowest cost possible from OKCoin. OKCoin is also the Bitcoin exchange available in the most countries around the world, so it will hopefully be accessible for you wherever you are. Go to OKCoin.com to get started with your stacking. Nodal 1. As discussed in the Bitcoin Standard, Bitcoin is controlled by the nodes that operate its software. It is only through consensus between nodes that the Bitcoin blockchain continues to live, and it is only by running a Bitcoin node that you are part of this consensus and can verify the validity of the transactions you receive and the ownership of your coins. Whenever anyone asks me what are the most important warning signs that something is wrong with Bitcoin, I always answer the following. If the number of Bitcoin nodes is declining, and or the cost of running a node is rising significantly. I believe it is really important to run a node, but I don't recommend running it on your work or personal computer as it can compromise the performance of your computer and, more importantly, the security and privacy of your Bitcoin node. A far better solution is to buy a dedicated hardware node, and for that, I highly recommend Nodal. Manage all your Bitcoin activity, such as Lightning or BTC Pay server, and isolate them from your personal computer by putting them into one dedicated device that is always running and does one thing only, Bitcoin. Become a first-class Bitcoin citizen by running your own Nodal node, available at nodal.it, and that's spelled N-O-D-L.it. Finally, Cold Card. My hardware wallet of choice is the Cold Card. I strongly recommend only conducting Bitcoin trades on computers that are dedicated to Bitcoin and cannot connect to the internet. I like the Cold Card because it is a contained machine optimized for Bitcoin and Bitcoin only. Cold Card is basically a small computer that can only do Bitcoin, which makes securing it more straightforward. Use the code BitcoinStandard on coldcardwallet.com to get a 5% discount.
What is Bitcoin's utility and the value of Bitcoin? What is the price that it should be trading at? Well, we're here to discuss these topics with three very prominent guests, experts in their respective fields with various viewpoints. Dr. Saifedean Ammous, independent educator at saifedean.com, who is also the author of The Bitcoin Standard, Hong Fang, CEO of OKCoin, and Steve Hanke, professor of applied economics at Johns Hopkins University. Gentlemen and lady, welcome to the show. And Dr. Ammous, it's your first time. Welcome to Kitco.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
It should be a fun discussion about Bitcoin. I know you have all very good opinions and viewpoints on how people should perceive Bitcoin and the role that it plays for investors. I like to start with Bitcoin's utility and its intrinsic value, because that is a foundation of this discussion. Hong, ladies first, you have written an essay about this very topic and why you think Bitcoin should reach $100,000. Is that still your price target, Hong?
Short term, yes. Yes. Absolutely. Okay. So when I think it's interesting when you mention intrinsic value, and the keyword utility. I think those two are very important to understand when we talk about a quote-unquote an asset class. To me, Bitcoin is a very special asset class. It's not just a asset class, because when we talk about asset class in the traditional financial world, it is a asset class that, you know, it's a type of asset that generates certain cash flow or be valued in fiat money, i.e. US dollar or any other fiat money that you can speak of. But Bitcoin, to me, is not falling into that category. It is this very special asset class that actually provide the central utility as a best that we have as a store of value, the best store of value that we have ever had in the human history. That is what makes it very special. I think we talked about this previously on your show. Mm-hmm. The reason that Bitcoin is very special and unique, and compared to gold and many other historical store of value format that we've seen historically, it is very scarce, right? It is divisible, it is durable, it is fungible for many other things. But the most important thing about Bitcoin is that it takes out any third party from the creation and management of this asset and make it very censorship resistant, make it free from inflation, which has been the most, the biggest quote unquote evil, if you will, that has plagued our financial system and our currency system historically. So that's how I've been viewing it compared to many other asset classes out there. It's very special. You cannot think about it as a comparable to stock or bond or whatsoever, because it shouldn't be think of in that session, in that framework.
Okay. I'll let each of you make a statement and then you'll have a chance to respond to each other. Dr. Amos, you've talked about Bitcoin and how it relates to Austrian economics and its role for investors and economists alike. Can you elaborate on this concept?
I think, the foundational concept of Austrian economics is the idea that value is subjective. And I think the term intrinsic value makes really no sense in the context of economics. In the context of finance, it's used to denote the value of the discounted expected future cash flows of a cash yielding asset. But that's not that's different from how we think about value as in economics, because a lot of things don't yield cash flow and they're still valuable. And so the value of anything comes from somebody valuing it, and that is subjective. There's no right and answer over how much a person can value something or they should value something. It is entirely subjective. It is down to the person themselves. So there's no economic value without a human being making the valuation consciously from the scarcity of the good that they're valuing. And so for me, Bitcoin has proven itself to have a value on the market for 12 years, and the market continues to exist liquid in a very liquid form. I can understand how somebody won't see value in Bitcoin for themselves, but I don't understand the idea that we can dismiss a $1 trillion of asset being held by people all over the world as not having value. Well, somebody is holding all of the $1 trillion of Bitcoin that are out there today, and they could be selling it, and they could be buying things, and they could be buying a lot of things for $1 trillion worth of Bitcoin, but they choose to hold the Bitcoin. So there clearly is value from it, from holding Bitcoin. And that's I think, what economists should be asking themselves. Why?
Okay, excellent. And Professor Hanke, last time we spoke about Bitcoin a few weeks ago, you made the rounds of the internet by saying that, I quote, Bitcoin's fundamental value should be zero and it's going to eventually death spiral down to its fundamental value. Can you elaborate on this view?
Well, first of all, I did say that, and the fundamental value of something is very different from the market value. The only objective value of anything is the market value. And the market value is, as a good Austrian, I can conclude, the summation of the subjective valuations of the market participants who are engaged in buying and selling whatever it is in the market to determine its objective market price. So these are just classifications and terminologies that are used in economics. So the market value of Bitcoin is what, 55,000 today or something around that. I haven't looked the last hour, so it moves around. What do you have there, David? Do you have it on the computer?
Yeah, something like that.
It's something around 55,000. That is the market price. That is the objective value. And that is determined by subjective valuations of market participants. And that's clear enough. The fundamental value of something is, and at the limit, whether it's generating either utility of some sort or free cash flow. A stock, we value that by looking at its free cash flow or projection of that, and that's added together by all the analysts, all their subjective valuations, and they're buying and selling and recommending, and ultimately you get a market price, which is the objective value. I think the reason that I think this is the fundamental value is important to keep in mind is that there's free entry into the crypto space, and Bitcoin I think has inferior characteristics to what could be superior cryptos that will eventually drive it out of the marketplace. And when that happens, the supply is completely inflexible and inelastic, but the demand determines the price. The demand determines the price. And if the demand disappears because people go to superior substitutes, then the price will go down to its fundamental value, which happens to be zero.
Okay. Hong, I'll let you respond to that. Professor Henke made a point that Bitcoin doesn't generate any cash flow, and so that's one of his assumptions for why the fundamental value of this asset is zero, because it doesn't generate cash flow. Do you agree with this statement? Is it true that Bitcoin doesn't generate cash flow?
Yeah, I actually want to respond to Professor Henke's point on several aspects. Professor Henke talked about fundamental value, which I actually agree with. I think when we think about a future price of a quote unquote asset class, we want to think about what the utility of that asset. Yeah, is it something that generates cash flow and then should be valued in terms of discounted cash flow, or is it something that is more providing utility that's not driving cash flow, but certain utility that people just want it. As a result of that, the value of that should be put in the framework of a supply and demand framework. And I think in Bitcoin's case, it is the latter, right? It's not generating cash flow. It is a supply demand play. It is the best store of value, so that if many people, depending on how many people actually see it as the best store of value, when that size of the population changes, the supply and demand dynamics changes that will drive the change of the price. Now, what I do believe in is that when you look at Bitcoin versus all the other competitors out there as a store of value, either historically or in fiat world or in crypto world, there's no other asset or whatever format that you can think of that offer more superior attributes than Bitcoin. So the second point that intrigued me in Professor Henke's comment just now is that when he mentioned the supply and demand and acknowledged the change of supply and demand will drive the price of Bitcoin, he mentioned that there may be other assets in crypto world that may come up with more superior attributes that may drive Bitcoin out of this competition. And I don't agree with that, at least not now. I don't see any other assets that in crypto that can actually offer more than what Bitcoin can offer at this point. There have been forks out of Bitcoin, but those failed. And the other thing is, when you think about store of value, when you think about the consensus forming around that, and ultimately as a monetary network, there is a significant network effect there, depending, because back to Professor Saifedean's comment, it's almost like a game theory. When you think about either historically gold or silver or any other project commodity serving as store of value, or Bitcoin serving as store of value. It depends on how you think other people will think of this as a potential lasting, durable store of value. And there is a network effect. And the longer Bitcoin's play out, the larger the networks becomes in the total market cap, the harder for the competitor to come up and challenge it. It has to be not just 2 times better, not just 10 times better, has to be 100 times better, just like what Bitcoin has been doing with fiat currency, with gold. It is 100 times better. It is a native internet money, native store of value to the internet. That's what makes it so special. And it takes out government, central banks' hand totally, totally, like zero, like absolute separation of money and state. That's what makes it so special.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. Dr. Emmons, I have a question for you, but before I let you, before I ask you the question, I'd like to give Steve a chance to just respond directly to Hong's comments.
Well, the one thing that there are a number of things that could be said, but the main thing is there are 7 characteristics of great currencies, and Bitcoin just doesn't fit the bill. If you go back, I've studied these things, the dominant currencies for 2,500 years. There have been 14 great currencies, and the network effects are very important, obviously. The average length of life of each one of these is about 200 years. Well, Bitcoin hasn't been around long enough to say anything about its store of value. So that assertion is kind of ridiculous on the face of it. The one thing that we do know is that gold, there is something called the golden constant. Roy Jostrom's book is titled The Golden Constant. And from 1560 up until the present, gold has been something that holds its purchasing power over long periods of time. There are variations and volatilities, but if you look at the ratio of wholesale prices over the price of gold, the gold price, it's about 1. That thing stays pretty constant over hundreds of years. So we have a long test there when we're talking about store of value, holding purchasing power. Gold has in fact stood the test of time. Now, what are these 7 characteristics? Well, 1 is the size of the transactions domain. And the size of the transactions domain for Bitcoin is tiny. It's not used for anything. This is a pure speculative asset. You have to look at the greater fool's theory of speculation to figure out what's going on. And that is, you can buy it today. Its value is what it is. And if you think it's going higher, you buy. If you think it's going lower, you would sell the thing short. So where it's going, no one really knows. I have no idea where the thing. Hong might be exactly right. It's going to 100,000 per unit in the short run. But the second thing that is required out of these 7 characteristics, stability of monetary policy. 3, absence of any kind of controls. 4, strength of the issuing state, because all the great currencies have actually been issued by states. And 5, until 1971, there was always a fallback factor. In other words, the great currency was issued, but it could be convertible, usually into gold or silver in some cases. And the 6th thing is that there's some sense of permanence. In other words, you can price deferred payments or long-term contracts in whatever this is. It has to be a unit of account that's reliable. And as a result of that, interest rates are low when denominating contracts in these things. Mm-hmm. So all of these normal things that have been associated with every great currency for the last 2,500 years, you just can't check the box on Bitcoin. It just doesn't have it.
Okay.
It is a speculative asset, and you have to think in terms of a speculative asset in which the greater fool's theory is the name of the game. And you're talking about something like the South Sea bubble or the Mississippi bubble of 300 years ago in the 1720s. That's what's going on. It might go a lot higher.
Okay.
It might go a lot lower. And by the way, I can design a superior crypto.
We're going to talk about that in just 1 second, Dr. Hanke, your alternative crypto. Dr. Amos, let's give you a chance to respond. So I guess two questions now. First of all, Hong and Professor Hanke have both given their targets for what Bitcoin should be trading at. What is your fundamental value target? Is there one for you?
Yeah, and David, I don't have a target. This is a speculative asset that I have absolutely no target about, but as superior alternatives come in, and they will, entry is very easy. Forget the networking thing. Mm-hmm. Entry is very easy. If you come up with a superior one, the demand for Bitcoin will dry up and it'll go down to almost nothing.
Okay, I see. Dr. Amos, your response?
Well, my question is, we've already had 12 years of supposedly superior alternative coming on and entering the market. There are thousands of digital currencies other than Bitcoin. Not only have they failed to replace Bitcoin, they've also all failed at getting to 10% of Bitcoin's liquidity size. I think that there's no comparison between Bitcoin and other digital currencies in any meaningful sense. They've failed to challenge it at all, and Bitcoin has just been continuously growing for 12 years at 200%. So the question that I have here is, there comes a point at which Bitcoin is bigger than the US dollar. There comes a point at which Bitcoin is bigger than the global bond market. If more people have money in Bitcoin than the bond market, imagine $100 trillion being held in Bitcoin. Currently we're at 1 trillion, but imagine it goes up another 100 fold. That is probably bigger than the global bond market. Now, it doesn't have to satisfy your textbook definitions of what makes a great currency, because that refers to the currencies of governments issued in the analog world. It has to win the test of the market, and you have to think about it as a market good out there competing for people buying it. So if more people buy it and we end up with more people holding Bitcoin than government bonds, doesn't matter if it fulfills your criteria in your textbook. It's already become a store of value bigger than bonds. So my question to Professor Hanke is, if it goes up to $5 million of Bitcoin, it's bigger than the bonds. Would you then consider that, okay, maybe it has a little bit of value itself to the $100 trillion worth of, to the people holding $100 trillion worth of it?
If it's $100 billion and that's the market value, that's what it's worth. There's no question about it. All I'm saying, and you're missing the point in these definitions, it is not a currency, period. That's the end of the story. I haven't listed all 14. I'm not going to go back to the Greeks and go through every currency. I was talking about great currencies, great international currencies that satisfy the definition of a currency. I wasn't talking about a speculative asset. And if the price goes up and the value exceeds the total value of all bonds outstanding in the world, that is the value of whatever Bitcoin or the crypto is. That is the objective value. That's the point.
Would you still think the fundamental value is zero?
Pardon?
Would you still say the fundamental value is zero?
Yeah, unless there's some uses that ultimately show up and the thing starts being used for
itself. People buy $100 trillion worth of Bitcoin. There's 7 billion people around the world holding $100 trillion worth of Bitcoin. That sounds pretty useful to me. They must have a reason for holding it.
No, they do. They're speculating. It's a speculative market and a speculative asset.
You say that like it's a bad word, but everything you do is speculation.
I'm not saying it's like it's a bad word. I think speculation is a wonderful word. I spent most of my career speculating in foreign exchange and commodities, equities, and bonds. So I don't need lessons on whether speculation is good or bad.
Dr. Amos, I'd like to draw your attention to a comment that Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell has recently made this week in his testimony. He said that crypto assets are highly volatile and therefore not useful as a store of value. He said it is a speculative asset
that is essentially a substitute for gold rather than for the dollar. What assumptions is Fed Chair Jerome Powell making here, and do you agree with his statement?
I think, you know, he's probably correct to the extent of his own preference. He seems to prefer currencies that lose value steadily over time with general predictability to currencies that gain value with some volatility. And I think, you know, there are different flavors of ice cream in the world, and there are different kinds of currencies. And the beautiful thing about Bitcoin is that it's now offering us a free market test. We're watching all those national currencies built on the idea that they need to lose value every couple of years to stimulate the economy grow. We're watching them up against a currency that gains value. So, you know, Powell is welcome to hold whichever he wants, but I think, you know, the market shows Bitcoin has appreciated 200% on average every year over the last 10 years. I think, you know, Professor Hanke and Professor Powell need to be asking themselves a little bit more about what is it that people see in this thing? Why has it not been displaced by all the other cryptocurrencies? And I think the point that I'd like to make to Professor Hanke is when you were mentioning the specifications of a great currency, Bitcoin effectively has one that substitutes for most of them, which is the fact that nobody controls it. Nobody can change the supply. It's been 12 years, it's $1 trillion, and nobody has figured out a way to make more Bitcoin, more than what is originally scheduled. So this is the first thing that is truly scarce. And this is what distinguishes Bitcoin from the other currencies, because none of them has demonstrated the degree of immutability that Bitcoin has, which assures everybody in Bitcoin that they can be 100% certain almost that there's never going to be more Bitcoin made. You can't get that kind of security from any of the other networks. And I think this is a very, very important point about what gives Bitcoin value.
Dr. Amos, I have one more follow-up question for you. You're currently living in Lebanon, where you experience and can observe very high levels of inflation. Now, if I were to present to you options for hedging inflation, let's say gold, Bitcoin, stocks, government-issued bonds, for example, what would be your preferred instrument to protect yourself from inflation with?
I mean, well, I'm not living in Lebanon anymore, but my preferred instrument would be Bitcoin, because I think, you know, the important characteristics of money, the important characteristic of money is saleability. It's the degree to which you can sell it without it losing its value. And I think in Bitcoin's case, there are two parameters for saleability: saleability across time, the ability of money to hold on to its value across time, and saleability across space, the ability to move money across space. And I think Bitcoin wins hands down compared to fiat currencies and gold in that regard. Its ability to hold on to value across time is very good, and it's outstanding. It's 200% appreciation a year, but it's also very cheap to send halfway across the world. And this is when people talk about Bitcoin not having utility. You can send money from the US to China in a couple of hours without having to use any of the national government infrastructure and institutions like the central bank. This is an enormous advantage, which places in Lebanon, you know, they're beginning to see the value of that, because the dollar might be great and it's more acceptable than Bitcoin in a place like Lebanon, but you can't send the dollar abroad because the banks won't let you. The banks are closed, there's capital controls, and there's all kinds of problems. Bitcoin gets around that.
Mm-hmm. Well, on Lebanon, David, let me just make a remark, because sure, it's something I follow hour by hour. Actually, in the last year, the Lebanese pound has shed 81% of its value. And today, I just measured the inflation rate. It's 378% per year. They are hyperinflating. They started hyperinflating in July. But this gets to the point about Bitcoin versus the dollar and use and utility. Everyone wants what in Lebanon? They want dollars. Everyone around the world does, and this is a utility. Almost all commodities traded in the world are invoiced and priced in dollars. 40% of all trade, manufacturers, commodities, everything else, are priced in dollars. 60% of all central bank reserves are in dollars. 90% of every foreign exchange transaction has a dollar on one side of the trade. So in terms of use and use value, the dollar is the great currency. It is the international currency. Mm-hmm. All this Bitcoin talk, it's a minor footnote in terms of utility and use.
There must be a price at which you would have to, if you think it's small, then it has to be able. You have to be able to name a price at which you would admit that it's no longer small. It's no longer a footnote because it is much bigger than it was last year in Lebanon. It's not as big as the dollar yet, but it's much bigger than what it was last year. So if the trend continues, you know, at what level would you admit that this is just something that people can use? It works. It does what it says on the tin. You can send it across the world, and it maintains its supply.
It takes time. When Elon Musk first started to invent electricity car, people in the traditional auto industry think that that was just a joke, a footnote. But now Tesla is the most valuable auto company in the world. So it takes time. And when the paradigm shifts, it comes slowly and then suddenly.
But I'd like to ask Professor Hanke to specify a price at which Bitcoin becomes big enough for him to stop saying it has a fundamental value.
Well, you just measure the measurements that I've given you, the dimensions that I've given you.
So Bitcoin is currently around
1% of the Bitcoin. In other words, how many commodities, when are we going to start pricing oil and Bitcoin? When are we pricing corn? When are we pricing wheat? Okay, that's a commodities. When are we going to start pricing cars and manufactured goods and Bitcoin? You're talking about the speculative aggregate moving this thing around. I'm talking about the uses of it in transactions.
Being used in transactions, Dr. Hanke. It's probably just not as visible to us in US than to other people living in different regimes where inflation is super taking away their health. For example, in Latin America, there are a lot of commercial entities in their export business. For example, with Asia, they're selling commodities to Asia. They transact in Bitcoin.
This is an academic footnote. The dollar dominates all of these transactions.
Yeah, but the British pound dominated at some point, and it doesn't anymore. Just because it does,
That's exactly my point about entry of a competitor, a superior competitor. And the U.S. dollar became superior after World War One and drove the British pound sterling to the sidelines. I think, as someone who embraces the idea of digital currencies, which I do, and I think that is the future in cryptos. The question is, what kind of superior product would be desirable? And I think a currency board type crypto would be. Now, Facebook with Libra tried this, but they had no one on the team obviously understood currencies very well and how these things work. It turns out I've established four currency boards in my life. One in Estonia in 1992. They didn't even have a constitution that had been approved yet in June of 1992. We established what? We established the Estonian krone with a currency board backed 100% with reserves. We did the same thing in Lithuania in 1994. We did the same thing in Bulgaria in 1997 when they were facing a raging hyperinflation with monthly inflation peaking out at 242% a month. We installed a currency board. And Bosnia and Herzegovina wiped out by civil war in 1997. In August, we established the currency board. All these things work. There are no preconditions. The currency board does issue a liability. That's whatever the local currency or whatever you call it. It could be a private currency. Mm-hmm. I'm advocating now private currency boards. So you issue a liability, and that liability is backed with 100% reserves of some anchor asset, and the local asset or asset issued by the currency board trades at a fixed exchange rate that's freely convertible with no restrictions to the anchor. Mm-hmm. And that
they're called stable coins. They're out there. They're done.
They don't work. They haven't been audited. They've had all kinds of problems. And that's precisely why they have not been able to nudge. They have reduced the market share of Bitcoin, but they haven't really been able to put it out of the market and compete. They're very inferior. And we had a stillbirth with the Libra white paper actually did mention the words currency board, but it was a false start. It was improperly done. And I think if one was done right, or others were done right, they could be very competitive with Bitcoin and would in fact be superior, actually.
I have a few more questions. Hong, I will let you talk about other forms of cryptocurrencies, but Dr. Amos, let's talk about the Bitcoin standard. So a currency regime backed by cryptocurrencies, is this possible? Could it happen?
I think so. I think Professor Henke is stuck at the mental hurdle of thinking of currency purely within the nation state central bank paradigm. And I think I'd love him to just make the leap of imagining that we've gotten software now that gets around the central bank, gets around the need for a currency board, and just establishes market value, allows market value to accumulate into a free market good that is controlled by nobody. It's not a good that is physical, it is digital. But if I take your computer right now and I return it in the same physical form, but I erase all the files of it, that won't have the same value for you, that computer, right? It's still physically the same, but the digital stuff on it is where you have value. So we can attach value to digital things. What Bitcoin does is that it allows us to replace the bottom layer of central banking and central banks and currency boards with a protocol that is set in digital stone, effectively, and, you know, has demonstrated incredible credibility in maintaining its supply and in maintaining the integrity of the network over 12 years. So the question then becomes, you don't need a currency board for Bitcoin because it would defeat the entire point, because then you have a bunch of people who control it and those people can abuse the authority because they can always issue more liabilities than they have. Bitcoin prevents that possibility entirely. Instead, what we are going to be getting is Bitcoin replacing the currency boards and the central banks, and then we're going to build second layer solutions like the stable coins and like the currency boards and like commercial banking backed by the Bitcoin base layer.
Okay.
Well, what you say about the currency board, it really isn't right. That's technically, you've got things all mixed up. A currency board is not a central bank. It's something completely different. Right. And you could have, by the way, what I've been advocating, and that is a gold-backed currency board with gold as the anchor. Now, who issue the liability of gold? Who's issuing that? Whose liability is gold? It's nobody's.
Let's let Hong respond here.
Because I think there are a couple of things that we have discussed back and forth, but I would like to actually go back to almost like take a first principle mentality. And Dr. Henke, I commend you on your track record of setting up a currency board historically and making that valuable to the people in those countries that have suffered super inflation. One question I would like to ask you to think about is why would the currency board succeed, right, compared to some of those local currencies? And also, when you talk about the list of good currency standards for a good currency or solid currency, I heard that you mentioned something that I think is very interesting and actually crucial. You mentioned something that's called monetary policy stability. I think that is really important. That is actually the key point. When Paolo was talking about Bitcoin's volatility, I think he's mixing up with the price volatility and the monetary policy stability. I think whenever we talk with historically, when people people around the world who have been chosen gold as the store of value historically before sovereign currency came up, that's because gold is more predictable, right? That level of predictability in its monetary policy is what is driving its success historically. And when you think about all the currency board that has been successful. And those they have been successful because they have been more predictable than those local currencies issued by local central banks who have no discipline in their monetary policy. It is totally unpredictable.
Professor Hanke talked about superior forms of cryptocurrencies that would one day dethrone Bitcoin and drive its price down. Do these currencies already exist? Are there alternative coins out there that you see fitting this definition?
No. There is no superior form currently that is more superior than Bitcoin, that is more predictable, that is verifiable. Actually, Dr. Hanke was talking about the potentially creating a currency board that is more superior than Bitcoin, maybe pegging against gold. How verifiable is that? Bitcoin is a network that is P2P, that's sensitive, censorship resistant. Anyone, if you are interested in setting up a node and check it out, you can check it out. You can verify it. It's verifiable to anyone, everyone in the world, right? How can that be done for gold? You have to have a third party running the reserve, checking it, and have then invite other third parties like auditors and legal counsel to verify that. There are a lot of potential points of failure in that process. But in Bitcoin, there is no single point of failure. That is what has been making it super exciting and different and unique and superior to all the other alternatives that we have in our traditional mindset. And again, I agree with Dr. Saifedean on the comment that when you're talking about the currency criteria, those are our currencies issued by government, issued by central banks. But that's an assumption. That's not a given. Like in our history of monetary usage for human beings, not all the civilizations are using currency issued by central banks, issued by the government. Mm-hmm. Gold for a long time is not issued by any government or bank. It was later taken by the government as kind of the reserve and asked the people not to use it other than being a reserve, right?
Well, we had private banking. The unit of account was something that was indicated or established by a government, but the issue of private money was very common. So what you're saying is just not correct. There was a lot of private money and private issue.
Those private monies are issued by third parties, by individuals, either an individual person or individual organization. In Bitcoin's case, no third party has been issuing it or controlling the supply or managing the management of it. It's all run on a protocol, like Professor Saifedean was saying. It was run on the open source protocol. Everybody can see it. Everybody who are interested enough to learn about it can go actually and run the node. Anybody who are interested in doing it can actually build on top of it. So, it's very different. There's no single point of failure. We're taking away...
What happened with the various scandals that have popped up, like Mt. Gox and so forth? How do you classify that? Wasn't that a failure? You say that this is a fail-safe system?
Yeah, Dr. Amous, I'll let you respond.
I'd respond if I pick your pocket and I take your wallet and I take $500 out of it, that's not a failure of the U.S. Federal Reserve Central Bank. The $500 are still working as intended. So when we talk about Bitcoin not being not failing and not being attacked, the protocol itself has not validated a single fraudulent transaction in 12 years of running. Now, real transactions were done on the network where somebody managed to take somebody else's keys and effectively stole their money. That is a feature in all money. If you can own it, it can be taken away from you. And so, the Bitcoin cannot remove theft from human nature. That'll always be the case. And as long as Bitcoin has ownership, it can be stolen. But the network itself continues to operate. So that's why I think, it functions better. It's better understood as a base layer for financial settlement layers and solutions that will be built on top of it.
Okay. I have one final
monetary. Yeah. I just want to emphasize again that monetary policy stability is really the key. And I would, okay. I would asked. Well,
yeah, I disagree with that, because we have a stable, inelastic supply of Bitcoin, and that by definition means that as the demand fluctuates, the price will fluctuate, and you'll have it's an unstable system. It isn't a stable system, it's an unstable system, because the supply curve is completely inelastic ultimately.
As a result of that,
the only process by which any adjustment can take place is the price. So the price will be very volatile.
Denomination of U.S. dollar or any other fiat.
Okay, I have one final topic that I'd like to address.
I just really need to make one small answer.
Sure,
to this.
Yeah, go ahead. One last point, we'll have to move on.
Yeah, Jastrom's book, The Golden Constant. Gold developed the most constant value over time and did that for centuries, as discussed in that book. But you look at gold's supply, it also didn't have a currency board. It also didn't have a monetary policy where somebody was practicing, monetary supply in order to stabilize the price of gold. In fact, what gave gold that stability was the fact that it had the lowest, least elasticity of supply response to demand. Gold is the one good whose supply increases the least every year because it doesn't corrode. So gold that has been produced over thousands of years is accumulating. And so marginal production is always very tiny. Because marginal new production is always tiny compared to the stockpiles, that's what gave gold its stability, because its market is predominantly a monetary market and very little demand for industry and very little impact of mining. So Bitcoin actually improves on that because it has a terminal growth rate of zero. So it should actually in time become better gold than gold in this regard. And I think volatility is going to be with us for a while because Bitcoin is still very small and it's going to grow. But I think, that before we get to the point where we can use Bitcoin to buy our coffee, there is an enormous stage to cross first, which is people need to build cash balances in Bitcoin so that they can trade other goods with Bitcoin. But we're nowhere near that. The total amount of cash balances in Bitcoin are less than 1% of total cash balances in the world. But as it grows, I think we're going to see more of that. So I think, from now until the point where you can buy your coffee with Bitcoin, there is an enormous, enormous opportunity of essentially a new asset monetizing that could eat up bonds and could eat up all kinds of other stores of value that people are using. So, you'll get your stability to buy coffee at a price of Bitcoin, maybe $1 million or $5 million. So, you're welcome to sit it out and wait out until then, or you can buy Bitcoins now, speculating on the fact that this is going to happen. And if you are correct, it will be massively rewarding in the long run.
Okay, I have one final topic, and I'll let you go first, Dr. Amos, because that was a good segue. The concept of central bank-backed digital currency. Now, this is being issued in some places already. The Federal Reserve in the U.S. has not indicated they are doing this immediately. Do we need a digital currency, a national unit of account backed by digital currency? What would be the motivations of implementing such a concept, Dr. Amos?
I think, central banks, their motivation is going to be to continue to do what are their main priorities and tasks, which is managing monetary supply and controlling payment clearance. So if they do build their central bank digital currencies, they're going to be digital, but they're going to miss the most important characteristics that make Bitcoin important, which is that Bitcoin's monetary policy is transparent, and payment clearance is automated by cryptography. So central banks cannot do this because it would defeat their entire purpose. They can't just replace their monetary policy with a strict code that they leave alone. That's not what they were meant to be made. So in my mind, what central bank digital currencies are going to lead to more efficient, more effective surveillance by central banks and more effective inflation by central banks. And so they're going to make national currencies less useful as a store of value in the long run. And I think ultimately they're going to serve as advertisements for Bitcoin's value proposition. I think that's the long run effect of it. When people realize the difference between what their central bank is giving them versus Bitcoin, I think that's going to be an enormous advertisement for Bitcoin.
Hong, what are your thoughts on CBDC, and what do you think is the future of digital currencies as an asset class?
On CBDC, my point of view is the same with Dr. Amos. I don't have anything additional to add. I think it's a combination, the worst of the two worlds. Let's see what happens.
So you don't think it's a good idea?
Well, it can help. It can help adoption. It can help promote awareness of digital currency. But it misses the most important point and actually strengthen the bad part of fiat currency system.
Okay. And Dr. Professor Hanke, I'll let you have the last word. Should central banks adopt Bitcoin or any other form of cryptocurrencies as a national unit of account?
Oh, no. And the confusion that's been brought in here about currency boards, by the way, currency boards, let me say unambiguously, they have no monetary policy. They have an exchange rate policy. They exchange one asset for another asset at a fixed exchange rate. And it's credible because the anchor asset that they hold covers the full valuation of any liability that they issue. So they're completely credible, but they are not
more liability. Until they issue more liabilities.
No, they can't issue more liabilities until they have 100% of the anchor currency as or asset as a reserve. So they have no monetary policy. You're just confused about this. You don't understand.
I think you're underestimating what I'm trying to say here. It's the fact that they stick to redemption is a monetary policy. So the fact that they continue to redeem it and they don't issue more liabilities, that is a monetary policy.
That's not a monetary policy. It's an exchange rate policy, but not a monetary policy.
Yeah, but the president can put a gun to the head of the chief of the currency board and they can make more money to finance a war or to finance some new hospital building or something like that. And so you're back at square one.
No, you aren't. The only way they could do that is if they brought in the anchor currency and exchanged it for whatever was being issued as a liability by the currency board. They cannot engage in monetary policy. You just do not understand the mechanism. So the mechanism can be broken
and it can be replaced and it can be changed.
I think Dr. Hanke, what you're saying is in a monetary board, there's no sovereign monetary policy because you're looking for free capital flow and also fixed exchange rate, right? So you have to give up sovereign monetary policy, i.e. the monetary policy for a monetary board is actually the monetary policy of the anchored assets. For example, if you're using gold anchored, that's the monetary policy of the gold that's actually being used.
Not really. Go to Hong Kong and figure out how the thing works. And you'll see that the quantity of Hong Kong dollars in circulation is strictly a matter of the demand for Hong Kong dollars. In that sense, it's just exactly like Bitcoin.
Okay.
It's the demand, the quantity of the issue of a currency from a currency board is strictly a function of only one thing, and that's the demand for that currency.
That determines
the quantity of the currency that's in circulation. There is no monetary policy.
We have to end it there because that's all the time we have. But I think you all got your points across. Thank you very much for your time. That was a great talk. Hong, Dr. Amos, and Professor Hanke, thank you all for participating and being on the show with us.
Thank you for having us.
I hope to speak with all of you individually again very soon. Thank you.